Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Eric Reed, the author of Selling the Yellow Jersey, The Tour de France in the Global Era, and the book was published by the University of Chicago Press in 2015. Hi there, Eric.
Hi, Roxane.
Could you get us started by telling our listeners a little bit more about yourself and what got you interested in working on France?
Sure, and thanks again for having me. I really started in college with no interest in France, but I decided I wanted to do a study abroad and kind of picked France out of a hat. I had very little knowledge in the language, very little coursework in the language, but I went and I absolutely loved it. And interestingly enough, I fell in love with France the same time I was falling in love with history, because I wasn't a history major. I was an international studies major. And I went to France as an undergraduate in 1989 and 1990. And so when I was there, all kinds of really monumental things that would interest anybody, regardless of whether they wanted to do history or not, were happening, the fall of the Berlin Wall and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I spent a little bit of my time traveling around, and I was in Berlin in November of 1989 and in Prague in early 1990. And just being there got me interested in history and my experiences in France, staying with French family, and just doing the study abroad in France made me fall in love with France. And so that's where my interest in France came from. And then, of course, I had to wake up and get a real job. I worked for a little while after I graduated as a temp secretary, and would work for maybe 9 months a year and then spend 3 months a year doing whatever. And that's when I first came across the Tour de France. Mm. I'd never seen it before. I'd been a sports fan my whole life. But my college roommate and I decided to go to Spain to follow Ernest Hemingway back when we were young men and experiencing our masculine yearnings, et cetera. And we went to, we were on our way to Pamplona, and we stopped in San Sebastian in northern Spain and came across the tour. And it was such a fun event. We hadn't planned it. We were just in this town, and the tour was beginning its very first day. And there were these big, famous bike racers there. Greg mm-hmm. LeMond, the American champion, some of the other big names that people might recognize, Laurent Fignon, mm-hmm. And others. And they were just there, right there, warming up. You could see them, smell them, hear them, because it was very close and intimate. There wasn't a big separation between spectators and audience as mm-hmm. there is in a lot of sporting events. And so it was just a really enticing event. Didn't think anything of it again until I went back to graduate school after a few years of working and decided I want to do something that I would consider to be living history, that history is still being created and a narrative that's still going on. And so that's how the Tour de France came to my mind.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I was reading the prologue where to the book, Eric, where you talk about your first encounter with the tour. I thought of my own first encounter with the tour that I hadn't thought about in many years. And I guess it was in the late 90s. And I happened mm-hmm. to be on a Ferris wheel near the Louvre just at the moment when the cyclists come around, and I hadn't been keeping track of the tour. I wasn't expecting it at all. And it was from up high, it was quite an extraordinary sight. And it was nice to be taken back to that moment reading the prologue to the book.
Well, you could probably sell that ticket these days. That's a prime seat to see.
It was amazing. It was an amazing view of it. Before we get started, Eric, could you just give us a brief overview of the tour? When did it start? How does it work?
Sure. It started in 1903. It was invented by a newspaper man who wanted to sell more copies of his newspaper, a guy named Henri Desgranges, mm-hmm. a newspaper man who started a sports newspaper in Paris that was struggling. And it was on the verge of closing, in fact, because it was just faring so badly. And so he and his editors came up with a promotional race that would be the most gigantic race that had ever existed. It was really based on earlier precedents. The road race wasn't invented by this guy, but this mm-hmm. one was just gigantic. But anyway, the tour is a month-long race, so about 3 weeks long race. It goes for about 20 different days. Each day, the tour travels to a different town. These are called stage towns. They're all men that race in the tour. Mm-hmm. And they're all on professional teams, at least they have been for the last half century or so. So they're all professional racers. The tour goes all throughout France. And in fact, this idea of France and its natural history and political history being reflected in the tour, the organizers had this in their minds by the way they constructed the itinerary. They would visit places that had historical significance, et cetera. And anyway, the tour is a race that takes, as I said, 3 weeks. And the racer who finishes the entire three-week race in the shortest amount of time wins. It goes through the Alps, through the Pyrenees every year, through the flatlands, through by the coasts, et cetera. So it really does have this sense of trying to make its shape reflect the different pasts of France.
I recently did an interview, Eric, with Felicia McCarron, in which we talked about the special status that dance has had in France historically. So your book begins with some discussion of France's love affair with the bicycle, and I'm quoting you here. What can you tell us about the history of the bicycle in France, and what kind of symbolic role have the bicycle and cycling played in the modern period?
Oh, thank you. That's a very good question and a big question. It's hard to answer with a short answer, but suffice it to say that France is one of the epicenters of modern cycling. It's one of the places where a lot of the invention of the modern bicycle comes about. Mm-hmm. It's a technological wonder of its era. It allows the human body to travel incredibly fast. And so there's a wonderment with it in France and elsewhere. I mean, really, there's this term of bicycle craze, with millions of people buying and millions of bicycles being produced around the turn of the 20th century in France, Britain, the United States, other places. Mm-hmm. But in France, there is this long-term cultural impact and meaning that the bicycle takes on that simply doesn't have the same kind of permanence in other places. For example, if you were to compare the bicycle craze in the United States and France, which I do to a little extent in the book. Mm-hmm. And the bicycle craze lasts a decade in the United States. And once the automobile comes about in the early 20th century, this takes the consumer gaze away from the bicycle, you might say. And the wonderment that used to accompany riding bicycles for men and women and children really dissipates. Whereas in France, you have this ongoing, ever-growing culture of bicycle riding, bicycle competition, the buying and selling of bicycles, and all of the things that are associated with a bicycle culture all the way through the 20th century. And so this is what I mean by this long-term love affair that simply doesn't manifest itself in very many other countries. And of course, France becomes one of these major epicenters of competitive cycling. Mm-hmm. The Tour is at the pinnacle of what France creates. And so this is another one of these reasons that the bicycle just has this special place in French culture.
So what about the relationship of the bicycle to the car in France? You know, I think of the car as a symbol of modernity beginning around this time, also in the early part of the 20th century. And so I'm just wondering about the way that those things relate to one another, those histories relate to one another.
Yeah, and it's not to say that the car never takes off in France. It does. In fact, there's a rich history of the French being one of the world's major auto manufacturers. Mm-hmm. But frankly, France is just drawn to the bicycle in a way that they're not drawn to automobiles. Automobiles, until the post-war period, post-World War II period, just don't have necessarily the same cachet as bicycles. They don't offer the same, people don't have the same access to them. They're too expensive for most people. Whereas in the United States, for example, there's about one car for every four people by 1930. In France, it's about 1 to 30, I believe is the ratio. I may be wrong about that. And so there's this ongoing sense of the bicycle having not only this cultural importance in terms of things like the Tour de France, but this ongoing place in the daily lives of people. They ride their bikes. They use it as a mode of transport in the cities, in the countryside as well. And this just doesn't go on in many other countries.
So, Eric, there have been some other studies, other scholars have worked on the Tour, and I'm just wondering how you would characterize your contribution to that scholarship on the Tour itself.
Thank you for asking that question. It was difficult. It was a difficult thing to do because there has been a lot of really good work done on the Tour. Christopher Thompson's book is probably familiar to a lot of your listeners. And it's a great book. I think it's the best book on the history of the tour in France. There's been some more recent work too. Hugh Dancy, who's a British scholar, recently wrote a social and cultural history of bicycling more broadly than just competitive cycling like the Tour, which is great. And it's about the history of the Tour in France. And so what I had to do was find a way to build on what's already been done. And so what I decided to do was address to some extent the history of the Tour in France, but broaden the context of what the Tour is. And so I focused on this issue of globalization and how the Tour has stories to tell about the way that France experienced globalization and also helped to instigate it. And that's really that second part is what I really hope to get out of the stories I tell, is show the way that the Tour de France illustrates how France and actors in France, whether they're cities, business people, bicyclists themselves, are agents of globalization. They have agency in this process. They make decisions. They actively participate in it and encourage it and embrace it. And so that's the story I try to tell on a lot of different levels, is this the Tour as a microcosm of globalization.
So, Eric, I know from reading the book and from speaking with you that you are a sports fan, and you mentioned this a few moments ago. Do you consider yourself to be a historian of sport? Is this a history of sport?
I guess in part, sure, it's the subject matter is sport. But I really consider myself to be a cultural historian. The story is of sport, but the broader history is one of cultural globalization. And so what I'm hoping to do is just, again, use this as an example of broader trends, this idea of cultural globalization. And what I'm really getting at is, again, the ways that I guess more recently historiography has shifted towards the process of globalization, and the way that historians have tried to look at France has moved away from what I would consider to be an old way of understanding it. France is a victim of globalization, resisting the process of globalization, or seeing the threats, solely the threats of globalization, and reacting against them in popular culture. And more recently, a lot of different scholars have taken the approach that I have. And I think I fit pretty squarely into this more recent last decade or so, eight to 10 years historiography of looking at globalization and France as being an active relationship rather than a defensive one.
In the introduction to the book, Eric, you present the work in terms of the interaction of three interrelated stories. The first being the Tour, France, and globalization. The second, small communities in a global society. And the third, celebrity athletes and Frenchness in a global age. So I'd like to explore each of these stories with you a little bit as a way of getting at the heart of the project here. So to begin with, the Tour, France, and globalization. So we've just been talking about globalization. I just wonder if you could say a little bit more about the term and how you're using the term and how you see the book contributing to historical and other debates about that notion as a whole.
The way I approach it is sort of a very broad definition. First of all, cultural globalization to me is multidirectional, institutionalized interconnectedness. Hmm. And it's really related to the Industrial Revolution, especially the changes since the mid-19th century, the rise of mass communication, mass exchanges of people over distance, mass consumer society, all these things that institutionalized interconnectedness on an everyday basis. And when you see the Tour and all of the things that make it work as a global institution, you can see these processes in action, whether it's the buying and selling things on a global level, whether it's mass media playing a role in sort of sharing meanings across vast distances and to vast audiences. All of these things come through in the way that the Tour's history works.
And how does the history of the Tour allow us to see the specific role that France has played in globalization, especially in the 20th century?
Oh, well, because you see, whether it's the Tour leaders and the masters of the Tour, whether it's the different actors that have interests in the Tour, such as the riders, the different businesses that are associated, they make active choices about engaging this process of globalization. Mm-hmm. Whether it's Henri Desgrange, this guy who was the founder of the Tour, at one point the Tour is floundering in the post-World War I period. And so he decides he's going to throw out the entire formula and start from scratch. What does he do? He goes from, in 1929, he decides to end corporate sponsorship of teams, most of which were French teams. Mm-hmm. And he decides to create a national team formula so that all the tour teams are based on national teams. And it would be more like the Olympics, an overtly internationalist approach to running this race. No other major race did that at the time. No other major road race like the Tour did that at the time. And you see, too, the role of these big celebrities, whether it's stars like Jacques Anquetil in the 1950s and 60s or Lance Armstrong more recently, these global icons actively engaging global audiences, trying to make money, trying to sell things, trying to convince audiences of what they stand for on a global scale. And so all of these active choices you can see in the history of the tour, whether they're French actors, mostly French actors, but not always just French actors either.
So, Eric, much of the book is a history of the media, journalists, different forms of media from print to TV, and I guess now increasingly, you know, the internet. How does a focus on the tour change how we might think of the history of the media in France?
I don't know that I'm interested in changing the narrative of the history of French media. But one of the things that's an interesting tension in the history of the tour and media is that the tour was, from its very beginning, absolutely 100% for-profit, a commercial enterprise meant to make mm-hmm. money and sell things. Whereas in the French media, especially as the broadcast media was coming up in the radio and early television age, the French government envisioned a not-for-profit sort of culturally uplifting role for the popular media. And the tension that you see in the tour is that the Tour de France is in some ways helping to push the not-for-profit media to embrace commercialism, because it is such a popular thing that people want to watch on television, listen to on the radio. And so you see over the long term, from the radio age into the television age of the 60s and so, more and more, because icons like the Tour de France are what you might call safe, commercial, very popular and safe commercial exploits, that more and more both the government and the people in general are a bit more accepting of commercialized popular culture, especially radio and television. So this is one of the sub-stories that you can kind of see the interesting tension playing out in the history of the tour.
Is there a kind of a history or a narrative or some sort of insight about French capitalism in looking at the history of the tour?
To a certain extent, yes. And I think it would relate to this idea of the way that this cultural institution interacts with the globalization process. Mm. There are some, I guess you might call them older historiographic debates about French capitalism as rather flaccid compared to the capitalist economies of other nations, about the role of government mm-hmm. in the French capitalism. And what you see here is a real success story on a global scale. Active pursuit of profit that's done very effectively over the course of a century. And yet at the same time, again, the French masters of this see themselves as somewhat conservative figures, even though they're constantly innovating in the way that they globalize the tour. Again, in the middle of the 20th century, you see this tension as the tour is becoming more and more mediatized with television. The Tour de France's Jacques Audet, in particular, this guy who led the tour for about 50 years after the Second World War, mm-hmm. Trying to limit the amount of publicity on television, limit the amount of televised publicity that comes out of the tour, because he sees himself as trying to conserve the non-commercial nature of the Tour de France. Yet at the same time, he's seeking these international audiences. He's changing the way that the tour itinerary is constructed so that it goes to different countries. And so this sort of innovativeness is really quite clear in the history of the tour.
You mentioned something a little bit earlier, Eric, about, you know, French politics. And I'm just wondering, you know, you cover, well, really the whole 20th century in the book and then reach up to the present by the end of the book. And I'm just wondering how the history of the tour intersects with some of the major political moments, you know, moments of crisis, war, regime changes, changes in, you know, forms of government, those kinds of things over the course of the period that you cover in the study?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think what I'll do is just give you some examples.
Yeah.
Suffice it to say that the tour saw itself as actively involved in projecting meaning about the history of France as it was going on.
Yeah.
Whether it was meanings about the writers or about the event itself, about even the spectators and the places that they visited. So just some examples. After the First World War, the tour tried to really embody the idea of the rebirth of a unified France. And so they constructed an itinerary that rolled all the tour riders through the recaptured provinces of Alsace and Lorraine with these very overt references to defeating the Germans and the dead on the battlefield and riding by monuments that were being erected to the fallen dead and the military victories, really as a way of just symbolizing this reunification of France. And the same was true after the Second World War. You see this, especially in the case of some of the host towns who were rebuilding after the Second World War, this attempt to use the tour as a way to convey the sense of rebirth, emerging from crisis, stronger than before, even though, of course, after the Second World War, France had suffered defeat.
Where does the state fit into all of this? I mean, I know this is a private project, but how does the private sector of the tour organizers and all of that intersect with the state and state interests along those lines?
Oh, yeah. The state encourages the Tour de France at all levels, but with different intensities and involvement. At the national level, there's not a whole lot of involvement of major government officials in the Tour de France. There are some publicized moments when presidents of France ride with the tour or comment on the tour, but it's not a statist enterprise. Apart from some ministerial involvement in giving permission to the tour to use national roads and use some police forces and things like that. But at the local level, you really see a lot of engagement. It's in fact really until the very recent history of the tour that the logistics of running the race were taken out of local hands. The early history of the tour, going into these archives in some of the provincial cities and provinces, you see this months-long process of both correspondence between the Parisian officials and the local governments, as well as these extensive preparations put in place by civil engineers, police forces. Local governments have to pay for and help to assure the gate receipts of the Tour de France when it visits their towns, as well as pay the tour to come. A lot of the tour's budget is derived from sponsorship from host towns. And so these local governments really take a major role in promoting this global spectacle.
I want to just sort of pick up on what you're saying there to ask you some more questions about this sort of second line of inquiry that you're pursuing in the book about small communities in a global society. So you look closely at two smaller communities in the book, at Brest and Pau. So can you tell us a little bit about these two places, why you chose them, and how they figure in the book?
Sure. And it was a total accident. I never intended to use these cities, but sending out 100 letters when I started the research, these places came up with having a lot of archival materials. So I guess that's how history works. you just find the places where you can find materials. And it turned out there were these really interesting stories. Brest is is at the very tip of the Brittany Peninsula, on the western tip of the Brittany Peninsula. It's one of these epicenters of Breton culture. And the interesting story of this city is that it was visited almost every year in the early history of the tour. So it was one of these major tour stops that the tour relied upon for logistical and financial support. And yet there was this ongoing argument and this constant sort of seeming hatred, not hatred, that's too strong a word, but this constant argument going on between the local and the national Parisian organizers that had this banter that was steeped in this Breton-Paris cultural hatred, where The local organizers constantly accuse the Parisian organizers of this cultural bigotry based on the fact that they're Breton and the organizers are Parisian. And you see it played out in these arguments that come to a conclusion in 1930 when Henri Desgrange decides he's going to omit the entire peninsula from the tour for the next 10 years because he's so fed up with all of these locals arguing with him. And yet after the tour, the history of the tour and Brest completely changes. And you see the local organizers kind of abandoning that old standing narrative and trying to use the tour, which is becoming incredibly global by this time, a global phenomenon, well-known everywhere, to try to promote themselves as a tourist destination. At first, that fails. That's the one reason that you don't hear of Brest as being a tourist destination.
That's true.
But, I don't want to go to the beach at Brest. But and then later, they in 1974, they have this gigantic 1 week long Breton festival of the Tour de France, where they try to promote the entire peninsula's integration into the international European economy. And so you see this active engagement of these globalizing trends, whether it's tourism or the economy, in Brest and its story. Poe has kind of a different story entirely. It is one of the administrative capitals of southwestern France. It's in the foothills of the Pyrenees. Mm-hmm. And it has this history dating back to the mid-19th century of being a wintering spa resort for really wealthy international people, some French, but mostly English people, Americans to a certain extent, come here and they spend months and months living there. And so this is the sort of economic and cultural focus of Poe in the up until the post-World War I period, when this economy collapses, the foreign tourists stop coming, they start going to places, other places that are far more famous now. And that's when Poe first welcomes the tour in 1930. They're trying to reinvigorate the local tourism economy by using modern publicity, the Tour de France. Mm-hmm. After the war, they try to do this again. It sort of fails. But nevertheless, you can see these in both the stories of Poe and Brest, these really active decisions by these communities to engage globalization for their own purposes, to use the Tour de France for their own purposes, mm-hmm. regardless of what the tour organizers in Paris are interested in doing. And so there are these compelling stories of local communities engaging globalization.
So I'm just wondering, Eric, what looking at the history of the tour might do if we take a step in a more conceptual direction. What does it do to the way that we think about the relationship between center and periphery or even the relationship between urban and rural in the French context?
Sure. One of the books that I loved, one of the first books I read as a graduate student was Peasants and the Frenchmen. And mm-hmm. it's one of those books that after I read it, I just didn't believe that history could be written like that. It was so beautiful. Mm. I couldn't imagine ever writing a book like that. And it's always remained that model from Peasants into Frenchmen has always remained in my mind as just a fascinating and convincing way to understand the way that modern French culture emerged, this idea of Parisians creating culture and disseminating it to the provinces. But and so I kind of went into this project thinking about the tour as one of these inventions of Parisians that mm-hmm. would be disseminated to the provinces. And on a superficial level, it was. But what you see in the stories of these host towns is kind of the counterexample to that, right? Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a Parisian invention, the Tour de France, but you see agency of the local communities at every turn of the tour's history. Mm-hmm. They can choose to accept it or not. They use it entirely for their own purposes. All they do is they pay a fee to the tour organizers, and then it's theirs. It's something they can use to either promote themselves economically or, in the case of Poe, which I didn't really finish my thing of my discussion of Poe, they kind of abandon the idea of using the tour as a economic promotion at all mm-hmm. by the late 20th century. And they just bring the tour every year because it's part of their annual cultural calendar. Just comes mm-hmm. to Poe every year, so they pay for it every year. And that's why that's how they want to use it. So you see real agency in the provincial cities and the provincial communities in the history of the tour.
I'm wondering, Eric, how the book engages with questions about you know, nature and space and environment and some of these issues? Like, is there a history of the environment or the space of France in looking at the history of the tour?
Absolutely. And again, whether you're a spectator, whether you're the organizer of the tour is one of these mirrors or prisms through, I hate to use that metaphor, but I guess I can't think of anything else off the top of my head.
Sure,
but
it's
one of these it's one of these metaphorical things that are used to project meaning. Right?
Mm.
And so the tour organizers actively, in the very early imaginings of the tour, they saw it as a recreation of conservative France, pre-Republican France even. When Henri de Grange wrote about the tour, he used terms that reflected the physical structure of France rather than the administrative structure of France. He talked about rivers and mountains, and he even used terms about the sort of pre-French revolutionary geography of France to try to convey this meaning of through the tour, this meaning of France, not as a Republican France, but as a far more conservative Catholic structure. More recently, I can tell you from my personal experience following the tour that there's been kind of a popular invective against the tour for more contemporary environmental concerns. The tour is maybe 5,000 people now, a traveling caravan of riders and followers that just throws its trash everywhere. And I mean everywhere. And I followed the tour in 1999 with a car and a tent for 3 weeks. And I'll tell you, there are also a million spectators in some of those stages. And the tour's passage just creates a local environmental catastrophe.
Wow.
There's trash everywhere. And so the tour has been trying to clean up its act somewhat. But to get to a more historical approach to this, one of the really interesting books that's come out recently is by Hugh Dancy's, a British scholar, Social and Cultural History of Cycling in France, which is not just about the tour. It is about the tour, but it's also about cycling more broadly as a social and cultural phenomenon. And one of the interesting things that comes out of his book is these parallel histories of cycling. On one hand, you have the story that I'm interested in, which is the commercial history, sport, competitive sport, commercial sport. But what he writes about is this parallel and ongoing history of bicycling that is as powerful and as important as the one I described, but which is all about engaging nature, health, cyclotourism, getting out and riding, becoming healthy, French people by the millions engaging with cycling as, in some cases, a very conscious alternative to the hyper-commercialism of professional cycling.
Eric, there's this third line of inquiry in the book, celebrity athletes and Frenchness in a global age. So I want to ask you about that. There's been some really interesting recent work on celebrity in France, especially in the post-war period. So how do you think about the book fitting in with that scholarship?
Oh, it builds on it. Absolutely. And in, there's that collection of essays on celebrity in France from maybe 2008. I can't remember the exact date. That was really interesting. It even included an essay on Raymond Poulidor, one of the big French stars of the Tour de France. And I build on that. I don't try to challenge it in any particular way. But what you see is because these celebrities are so just well-known and popular that they're imbued with meaning, whether it's the commercial sponsors who try to make their stars mean something to consumers or whatever. But what I try to do is, again, I try to take this onto a global level and build maybe some parallels with a scholarship that's been done on movie stars, for example. And so what you see are stars that are multi-directional in their meaning. So Jacques Anquetil, at the time he was the greatest Tour de France rider. He won 5 tours in the 1950s and 60s. But he was also one of the ambassadors, you might say, of the Tour de France to global audiences. It was because he was the star, journalists both in France and elsewhere wrote about what kind of star he was. In fact, he was a bit of an anti-hero. He didn't really conform, you might say, to the sort of idealized cycling star that the Tour would have wanted, for reasons I can explain, I guess. But then you also see figures like Lance Armstrong, who are not French at all, at least not French in the way that in their birth, but who, in Lance Armstrong's case, he comes to dominate a French race. but without diminishing it, at least until, of course, he was discovered to have been cheating the entire time.
Sure.
You would think that having a foreigner win France's national bicycle race would be bad, but in fact, I thought, until, of course, it was all undermined by drugs, that it really helped to enhance the standing of the Tour as the world's greatest bicycle race, because it confirmed that it was the Mecca. In sort of the way that the Olympics, it doesn't matter who wins, just the grandness of the event is important.
I hadn't realized until reading the book. I mean, when I read the book, I realized how little I actually knew about the Tour beforehand. I hadn't realized, you know, that shift from national teams to these commercial teams. What accounted for that shift, and when did that happen? I should have asked you about that earlier, but this is as good a place as any.
Sure. It was really because of concerns with competitiveness as well as commercialism. The stars of the Tour become so important and so powerful by the post-World War period that by the late 1950s, early 1960s, their sponsors simply aren't willing to allow them to race in the Tour de France without promoting their products. And so you see these... the Tour de France was still a national team formula where all these great superstars in their own right had to kind of subsume themselves to the national team.
Right.
And this just wasn't sitting well with either the stars themselves or their sponsors. And so at one point, Jacques Anquetil, this big star I was telling you about a few minutes ago, decides he's not going to race in the Tour. He's going to go race in one of the other great tours, the Tour of Italy, instead. And this is a real blow.
Right.
The Tour just... loses its status without its greatest stars. And so it's in the early 1960s that this issue comes to a head, and the Tour does two things. First of all, eventually it abandons the national team formula and just has professional commercial teams. The advantage of that is that each star gets his own team, he can hire riders to do nothing but serve him. The term is domestique, servant riders, whereas in the national team, you, as I said, you would just have these stars who had to race for somebody else. The other advantage is that they can invite more teams. Instead of just maybe 10 or 15 teams, the Tour expands its membership of invites to 20, 22, 23, 24, 25 teams, and they began to recruit sponsored cycling teams from all around the world, not just European teams. And so you see, again, it becomes one of these tools for globalizing the commercial structure of the Tour.
What about this issue of, well, talk about a big question, Eric, Frenchness?
Yeah. One of the things I try to argue in the book is that one of the aspects of globalization of the, of cycling is that there is this sense of Frenchness about the sport of road racing. Road racing has French terms, a certain kind of French culture about it. And I build this up by kind of using some models from things that I think are pretty similar, food and movies. You see this sense of Frenchness, French values, French meanings that at certain points imbue global cuisine with its practices, its language, and so forth. And the same is true of French cinema. There's this cinematic brand that's a global brand that's created by the French cinema industry. And you see that in the history of the Tour de France and cycling. First of all, in France, there's this incredibly well-developed series of races that act as what I call a French school for cyclists, where they are developed from very young age. They race in these local races. They have these this coaching system. It's not structured in any way, but it just ends up being pretty structured, that develops the great talents of French cycling, both foreign and domestic. One of the things, too, I may have mentioned this before, but people like Lance Armstrong, Greg LeMond, these American stars who win the Tour, they go to France. They get trained there. They join these French teams. They're taught how to do road races by racing in France, so you see this development of Frenchness coming out of this really well-developed sense of professional cycling And what does Frenchness mean in terms of qualitative aspects? There's this iconography of heroism in particular that goes with cycling. And you see it in some of the great stars like Raymond Poulidor, this sense of panache, this sense of enduring superhuman suffering, regardless of whether you win. And that's one of the interesting things about the canon, this sort of philosophical canon of the Tour. It's not so much winning that's important, although the French love winners, but it is racing in a certain manner, having a certain attitude, one that is French, that involves attacking, whether you win or lose, that involves demonstrating your ability to endure superhuman suffering, constantly being aggressive. Mm-hmm. And this sense is really the way that road cycling works around the world. And I argue it's because of the preeminence of the Tour de France and its ability to convey these meanings to large audiences.
So the book offers a fascinating analysis of the organizers of the tour and of the riders, and we've just been talking about celebrity. What is it that you're tracing in terms of the history of spectatorship of the tour in the book?
Yeah, and again, this goes to the idea of trying to lift the tour out of just a French context and put it into a global context, right? One of the things I'm really interested in is readership. And one of the unusual things about the tour is that even as the tour is becoming broadcast to really vast audiences of radio and television listeners, I think it's really the print medium that's the most important way that global audiences of spectators are constructed, both in France and elsewhere. Because physically, spectators never watch more than a few moments of the tour when they're racing by on a bike. And in terms of television, very few people watch the entire tour from beginning to end, but they read about it. Places like the United States, I trace a little bit of the interest in the tour in the United States in the book. There's very little broadcasting of the Tour de France at all before the very late 1980s. And yet there are, who knows, possibly millions of people who are reading about the Tour de France in their sports pages, following the Tour de France and in specialized sporting publications. And this sense of global audiences that have nothing to do with national boundaries, these communities of readers, is something that I find fascinating about the tour's history, and that you can really see pretty clearly if you can look at sources, which I thankfully was able to do. I'll just have a little side note there. I don't think I could have done the research I did without the internet and without digitization. I found really great stuff in the National Library of Australia, the National Library of New Zealand, and even the Google Newspaper Archive has wonderful, wonderful sources that you can track for me, it was either English, French, or Spanish. Those are the languages I could use, which you can actually trace some of these global readership communities.
So what role does class play in all of this, Eric, in terms of the riders who participate, but also in terms of the readers and spectators?
I guess, you know, class is one of these primary prisms of tour meaning in France. And it's been written about extensively by a lot of different people. Chris Thompson's book really goes into this in wonderful analysis. But you see this issue of class conflict, just broadly defined, permeating the way that people understand the tour, whether they're the organizers, whether they're the cyclists, whether they're the readers who are following the tour, spectators, all the way through much of the 20th century. So, for example, in the 1920s and 30s, there are these really just wonderful and evocative portrayals of the tour by different camps in the class struggle, you might say. On one hand, you have Henri de Grange, this sort of 19th century bourgeois conservative who writes, he constantly writes about the tour using this language of management versus worker, or controlling the worker. So he describes the tour as this well-oiled machine, these cyclists as machine workers who follow orders and are in perfect coordination. You really see this language of the workplace and of a real traditional bourgeois capitalist manager coming through. Whereas on the other side, you see these newspapers like L'Humanité, who use the tour as this to promote an invective against the very sort of interpretation that Henri de Grange and his ilk would promote. They talk about the riders of the tour as workers who are engaging in class struggle with Henri de Grange when they come into conflict with him over rule infractions and that sort of thing. There's this really big blow up in the 1924 tour when two of the most famous riders are thrown out of the race by Henri de Grange for a minor rules infraction. And this scandal is called the Galley Slaves of the Road scandal. It's one of these stories that comes up again and again. It's one of the primary stories of the tour that people remember. But this language of class struggle continues all the way through the post-World War II period. So, for example, in the 1960s, drug testing first becomes something that the tour and sports in general starts to engage in. Hmm. Really hadn't happened at all before that. And you see Jacques Anquetil, that great French rider I was telling you about a little while ago, he leads the tour riders in a strike, in a work protest. They march down the street during once they refuse to race in one stage. They march down the street together and talk about their rights as workers being infringed by the tour management that's trying to test them for drugs. And so there really is this heavy class conflict language. On the other hand, the riders themselves, even though they engaged in this, I think that their status as celebrities was far more important than their status as workers per se. And by the 1930s, I think except for the polemics of class, the writers themselves saw themselves as celebrities far more than as workers.
And who's paying attention to the tour? What do we know about the demographics of fans, readers and spectators?
I don't know that we know everything. But suffice it to say, if you just look at the newspaper and television coverage mm-hmm. of the tour in France, the readership of the tour in the early days was far greater than the physical spectatorship. Just the paper that organized the tour sold hundreds of thousands of copies of itself every day. Mm. And that one of the things that's happening in the print media in the beginning of the 1920s and 30s is that it's becoming much more diverse. You see general interest publications developing very large sports sections that are writing constantly about the tour. More recently, the tour, into the broadcast era, the tour claims to be, since about maybe the 1980s, the third most televised sports spectacle on Earth, behind just the World Cup and the Olympics. I don't think that's true, but it is true that the television broadcasting of the tour probably reaches a billion potential telespectators. I think most people nowadays actually, though, follow the tour on the internet. Mm. They follow it through live feeds. They don't watch it, or they watch, they read about it on blogs, Twitter feeds, and so forth.
You mentioned somewhere at the outset, Eric, that, you know, all the riders are men. And that's the way it's been historically. And so I'm wondering about a couple of things. What roles actual women play in all of this, whether in terms of organizing or watching or reading about the tour as spectators of some kind? And then also sort of related to this, I guess, just the issue of gender in all of this, and especially masculinity and the role that plays in your analysis.
Oh, yes. That's a great question. And I think that, suffice it to say that the tour as it was created and presented by those who created it was meant to embody a kind of unitary French masculinity, right? One that was very conservative, mm-hmm. one that had certain meanings that were controlled by those who were disseminating the meanings. I sort of described a little bit this sense of athleticism and masculinity that the canon of the tour was meant to embody. Now, as far as women, the tour itself has tried to engage women in different ways, but certainly not as athletes. Yes, there is a women's Tour de France. It was created by the organizers of the men's Tour de France, but quite honestly, they've never promoted it. It's never become very famous. There's been a lot of money put into it, and it just hasn't become much in terms of a globally known sporting competition. But on the other hand, the tour has always, ever since its early days, tried to engage women as consumers. Mm. And this, there was a real overt sense of this, that women were attracted to the tour as spectators and that they could engage as spectators. And so one of the innovations of the tour commercially was something called the publicity caravan. It was one of the ways after 1930 that the tour organizers tried to make more money, increase the publicity impact of the tour. And when you look at the demographics of that publicity caravan, it was this caravan of vendors and loudspeakers that would follow the race itself to promote products to all the spectators standing on the roadside. When you look at the demographics, a really large percentage of those vendors and loudspeakers were selling products to women, whether they were household cleaning products. There were some examples of wedding dress manufacturers and things like that. So obviously, the tour is trying to engage women as consumers. And you see that also in the celebrity culture that comes in the second part of the second, in the post-World War II period. Mm. I read with some amusement some of these autobiographies written by cyclists and ghostwriters, and they're ghostwriters in the post-World War II period. And it's almost as if they're writing to women, a lot of them. Bernard Hinault, for example, one of the great French champions of the late 1970s and 80s. He writes an autobiography where he talks a lot about his zodiac signs. He has pictures, advertisements in magazines of him in what I would consider to be pretty sultry, sexy poses that I just read as being meant to have women as audiences. And so there's this sense of engaging women as consumers, but certainly not as athletes.
And what about race in all of this? I mean, when we're thinking about Frenchness, it seems anyway that it's intended to be a white masculinity, a white French masculinity. You know, are there interruptions to that, debates about that?
Quite honestly, there are not great debates about it. And you're right, the sense of French masculinity is a white one, and it's a very conservative one. Mm-hmm. There are some interesting moments where you would think that something interesting might happen in this sense. Like, for example, in the early 1950s, for several years running, right on the eve of the Algerian War, the Algerian crisis, there are these national teams from North Africa that have riders that are representatives of French colonies in North Africa, Algerians, Moroccans, etc. And it just doesn't come up in the newspapers that I've looked at, in the publications I've looked at. In fact, some of the interviews, the riders themselves from these North African teams really have kind of an assimilationist view of themselves. They stress their Frenchness or that they belong to France, that they're French citizens. They don't really express much that I would find terribly interesting, so to speak, in terms of coming up with a counter narrative of masculinity that's coming out on the tour.
That's interesting. At the beginning of our conversation, Eric, you were talking about what got you interested in this project, and you said something about wanting to pursue a historical topic that continues to have a kind of a life in the present, right? And so the book ends with a discussion of doping and the tour on the world stage and with the discussion of some of these more recent crises. So I wanted to ask you, you know, what some of your thoughts on that history of scandal and the tour might be, and also, you know, what should we make of, in the light of the history that you explore in the book, what should you make of some of these more recent crises?
Sure. Yeah, I have to say that I was personally just flabbergasted by the way that this drug thing has exploded in the last 20 years. It's just the sport is dirty. It has been dirty, and there's no denying it. And I find it personally to be very disappointing. I was personally inspired by Lance Armstrong and his heroic comeback from cancer. And I just wish that the fairy tale would have continued, but alas, no. But I guess to the more historiographic answer to your question. Drugs, the doping problem, its biggest threat is to the iconography of the tour. It's the sense of the Frenchness of the tour, because so much of the meaning of the tour is based on this myth of riders engaging in superhuman feats of masculine athleticism. And obviously, that's simply not true. And it hasn't been true for 50 years. So there are stories of extreme dopers in the 50s and 60s, one of whom, Tom Simpson, keeled over and died in the middle of the tour because he was so hepped up on amphetamines that his body just collapsed. And so these myths about what the tour means in terms of its of French athleticism just have never been true. And the real struggle that the Tour has is that they have to find a new way to define this ideal of French excellence athletically. And one of the opportunities that the Tour has is to take the lead in coming up with a sense of drug-free excellence. And I really am pretty optimistic on two levels. First of all, I think that the Tour is so well established that it can afford to police drugs more and more stringently. It's just so well entrenched as a global spectator spectacle that I just don't think it can lose by doing that, even if it does lose in the short run. I also think, though, that this idea that scandal will somehow undermine the Tour, just it's not true, because scandal has always been a part of what the Tour does. Every single one of these, not every single one, I'm exaggerating there, but the thing that makes the Tour star narrative so rich is how fallible these people are, not just from drugs, but whether it's riders committing suicide, riders who just have these terrible moral failings, and these story after story about the great stars of the Tour shooting themselves in the foot, sometimes literally. In fact, there's one Tour star who, in the early 1930s, he retired and was kind of washed up, and he was killed by his lover using the gun that he himself had used to kill his wife 3 years earlier. I mean, there's just these constant scandals, deep, deep scandals involving the greatest hit. And so I think it's, when you come to this latest episode, as disgusting as it is, it adds to the richness of this scandal-ridden event. And people will continue to talk about it. But again, I'm pretty optimistic about the Tour, simply because it, unlike virtually any other cycling event, has the luxury of being able to, perhaps, if it has the will, it has the luxury of really going after drugs.
Well, Eric, I've taken up a lot of your time, but there's one last question that I want to ask you, and that's, what are you working on now?
Oh, thank you. Well, two things. I have a big project that's a dream, and then I have a little project that I want to do in the next few months. The little project that I'm working on this summer is a history of the Glasgow, Kentucky Electric Company. And that may sound like a very strange thing, but I just got my last promotion, and I can kind of do something just off the wall if I want to, and so I decided I would do that. The reason that I'm interested in the history of the Glasgow, Kentucky Electric Company is that I'm interested in issues of this sort of larger dialogue in American politics about government and whether it can do good or bad. And what I see in the history of the Glasgow Electric Company is a really vibrant, innovative electric company that is kind of a counterexample to what you might call the conservative narrative of how the government should get out of the way and let private industry do it. So Glasgow, Kentucky is really doing some unusual things in terms of its electric company. First of all, it was one of the first power companies in the United States to simply, out of the blue, because it thought it should, provide cable TV service and high-speed internet service. It did this in the late 1980s and early 1990s before most people had even heard of the internet. More recently, they're participating in the Elon Musk-inspired home battery storage project. Only a few communities in the United States have been chosen to take these test batteries, these home test batteries, where consumers can load up on electricity in off-peak hours and then use it during high-peak hours. And so it's just something that's really personally interesting to me. My longer-term project is one that's more would be more of interest to people in your audience, which is I want to do a study of small cities in the global age. The city research that I did was the most interesting in the Tour, in my Tour research, and I want to continue that, although not necessarily focusing just on French history. As you might imagine, this idea of large cities interacting with globalization has been written a lot of, but not small cities. And if you take cities that are small in the early mass age, middle of the 19th century, you can see some of these trends as they play out over the long term. Some of these cities, like one of the cities I'm considering is Cape Town, are pretty small cities, less than 100,000 people in the middle of the 19th century, and yet actively engage in the process of globalization to become global cities. Others have the same, are not success stories. And what I want to do is pick at least one small city on each continent some of which might be in imperial settings, others might not be, and sort of see how small cities interact with globalizing trends in different ways and how that you can really see in small cities active choices being made in a way that you just can't in large cities. And so that's what I find fascinating about it. So that's my long and short-term plan. Plus, I have small children, and I'd love to take them on this big dream project of mine, spend a summer in each one of these cities, and write up some case studies.
Eric, I just want to thank you so much for joining me and for writing the book.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Roxanne.